Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Hello, I'm Leila Slimani. You're listening to the Cultural Frontline on BBC World Service.
Hi, this is Michael Rakowitz, and you're listening to the Cultural Frontline on the BBC World Service.
Hello, I'm Tina Dehealy and welcome to The Cultural Frontline, the programme that explores the world we live in through the work and the voices of artists. Today we hear stories from musicians, writers and curators, exploring both place and identity through their work. And we start with a remarkable spiritual and lyrical journey. From gangster rap in an American inner city to ultra-Orthodox Judaism in Israel, our first guest, the musician Nissim Black, has come a long way in life and he's still just 31. Formerly known as D Black, Nissim released two albums before changing his name and religion, converting to Judaism 5 years ago. Speaking from our Jerusalem studio, he told his story to the Cultural Frontline's Dashiani Nivanaigam.
You can call me Nissim. Nissim, you've just been touring America, where you're originally from. What was your life like growing up there?
Very rough. I was in Seattle, Washington. My mother sold drugs, my father sold drugs. Like any good Jewish boy, I joined the family business very early on, 12 years old when I started dealing. I was already smoking pot when I was right around 9 years old. So I was exposed to a lot of violence, a lot of trafficking in and out of my house.
Music's always been a big part of your life, and your music's changed massively, right? Tell me about what music was like when you were younger and how you got involved.
I may have been born with a microphone in my hand. You know, my mother was a rapper, my father was a rapper, my grandfather was a musician, my great uncles were all musicians, so I really didn't have a choice. By the time I was 13, I recorded my first professional record. From then on, it sort of just took over my life, music. By the time I was 18, we started a record label.
So you recorded your first record at 13. What was that record about?
It was a gangster love song. It was called You Need a Thug. Stuff I probably shouldn't have been talking about as a kid. I don't think I want to repeat anything from that song.
We all have things we're embarrassed about when we're younger. So.
Yeah. The soundtrack of life at that time was obviously records from, you know, Tupac, Biggie Smalls.
Oh, I remember all of those.
So these are all like shaping society even. And everything was talking about drugs and fast life and different things like that. So you sort of pick it up yourself.
How did you begin the process of conversion?
I got into an altercation with this artist. He made a rap record against me. This led to a big brawl outside a nightclub. And then I got a call saying that the police were looking for me. The police actually had a friend of mine in custody. He was the one that went up after me and he tried to take the other person's life. He missed, but it led to a kill or be killed situation for me because they thought that I sent him to murder him. And so I started praying a lot, trying to find a different way out of it. After about 3 days, I got a call from the other artist. We squashed everything. We let it go. And after that, I realized for myself that I wanted to focus more on my spirituality. I didn't want to be in another situation that will lead me back down the same road. So I started searching, and every day I was spending maybe 8 hours between the different texts, the Quran, the Christian Bible. It just sort of started leading me closer and closer to Judaism.
What was it about Judaism in particular that drew you to it?
So I think the biggest thing which caught me was that Judaism doesn't believe that if you're not Jewish, then you don't have a place in heaven or in the world to come. That acceptance made more sense within my heart than looking around how many different people there are in humanity.
Is there a song of yours which reflects that period of your life when you were moving away from gangster rap?
A song called Close to Yah on my record Aliyah, which is basically my transition record. By the time we were doing the tour, I'd actually started my conversion to Orthodox Judaism. And I was singing the song, when the radio blast, I seen it all burn in a flash. We became more obsessed with the cash. Now every time that I have to rock a show, I'm contemplating heavy if I even want to go. But my commitments and ties in the game, they keep me in it because I could care less for the fame. You know, at that time, things were finally happening to us. You know, the first single off the album, it ended up on MTV, and things just were spinning out of control. And like at the height of everything, where everything could go to the next level, I didn't want to make music anymore. So I did step away actually for some time. I felt like I was being pulled spiritually, and that anything that was in the way, I had to get rid of. Music in itself, obviously, look at what I'm doing now. So I don't think it in itself was bad, but I have to rebuild that relationship with music.
You haven't always been known by the name Nassim, have you?
No.
Why did you change?
For one thing is, you convert to Judaism, you take on a Jewish name. And so that had already taken place in my personal life and my spiritual life. I felt like it was very appropriate to also change the name when I came back to music. We call this the Mikdash Panimi, this inner tent. This is the world makeover. Mashiach will come take over. You ain't gotta be me or see what I see. All you gotta do is take a look forward.
Lift up your eye to the sky, spread out your hands. So how has your music evolved as you've changed?
Over the last 8 or 9 years, I haven't been involved at all with any music outside of traditional Jewish music. But from what people tell me, we're still hitting the nail with the hammer. I recorded a song a few years ago that was released and went viral called Hashem Melech, and it was over more of a poppy sounding EDM style, which was honestly a sound that I hated with all my passion. Just really couldn't get into it, and I did my first rap over it, and I thought, like, wow, my vocal sounds really good over this. So I made a couple more records like that, and it sort of just led into a full project. The music and the content in itself is definitely expressing my whole entire journey. I have a song called Million Years to tell God that I came from a very far away place, and I'm very happy the fact that he brought me there. So because of that, I'm going to express my loyalty to him.
Are there any particular lines in A Million Years that really explain this journey of yours?
I came from a distance where everything was different, and I called out to you, and you showed me that you listened. From then we became best friends. I gave my all to you when you showed me who I am. I am staying by your side to bask in your light and your mercy I reside. Spending that time focused on my spirituality, and it got really loud for me to start to develop a love and a like for the things that he does. That's obviously been reflected in the music also. I wanna fly, fly away, far, far away from
this place where nobody can bring me down. After you converted to Judaism, you then moved to Israel. What was your experience of entering Israel?
When we came here, we had a lot of fears just because everybody always tell you, you know, you're black and it's not going to be so accepting over there, or there's a lot of turmoil, there's terrorism and blah, blah, blah. Everything that anybody could tell you. And we came here and had completely the opposite experience. We've been accepted in our community. We moved to Meir Shearim, which is an ultra-Orthodox neighborhood. And we feel very, very comfortable there. Our neighbors have been very accepting. All the kids, they're very young, so they were able to pick up the culture and they pick up the language very fast. And so now they're fluent, and most of the time now at the house they're speaking to each other in Hebrew. Me and my wife are trying to chase after them and use Google Translate to figure out what they're talking about.
Would you ever rap in Hebrew?
I think eventually, but I don't think being able to give directions to the taxi driver is enough, really. But I think as I have more command over the language, sure, maybe I'll try it out.
Nissim Black talking to the Cultural Frontline's Dashiani Navinaygan. Our next story is from one of Europe's most persecuted people, the Roma. There are around 11 million Roma living across the continent, and wherever they've settled, they face discrimination and marginalisation by society. For many years, the cultural identity of the Roma people has largely been documented by outsiders, with few Roma artists having the platform to tell their own stories. But now things are changing. Earlier this month, thousands of people gathered in Berlin from across Europe for the Roma Biennale, a celebration of Roma art and culture. Delaine Labar is the co-curator, and when I spoke to her from Berlin, she told me how she first came up with the idea with her late husband Damien.
Myself and my late husband, who sadly died at the beginning of December, were two of the 16 artists who were involved in Paradise Lost, the first Roma pavilion in Venice in 2007. We were hopeful that that would be something that happened every 2 years, but at the time, Damien was doubtful that that would actually happen. There was one more pavilion that took place, but obviously in the past 10 years there's only been two, and there should have been five in reality. So he had this idea that why didn't we do our own biennial instead, rather than waiting to be asked, because as we know, most people don't like asking gypsies to different events. He was correct in many ways, because it didn't really happen. So yeah,
why is it called Come Out Now, and why Berlin of all places?
Well, it's called Come Out Now because we saw coming out as having working on many different levels. So not just in terms of sexuality, but the, you know, when you come from certain communities, you can be working in different types of jobs or different areas, and you may be hiding your identity because of racism, for example.
What is life like for the Roma community across Europe today?
The situation across Europe is, in many countries, it's really not very good. I mean, no one really wants to talk about the issue of segregated schools and that people are living in really awful conditions. You know, no running water, no electricity, no refuse collection, very little access to medical care. A lot of women have also suffered from sterilisation without their consent. And these are all issues I think that many people within Europe really don't probably really want to talk about, because they don't want to believe that it's actually happening here.
There are 11 million Roma community in Europe, spread across the continent. So why Berlin?
Well, Berlin, me and my husband have been working here for some years now, and it just so happens that we seem to have had much more opportunity, and there seems to be much more openness to the type of work that we make and also other artists from our community make. And it seems that there is a willingness for collaboration and also for major institutions to get involved, which in many countries is problematic because of the way our community is perceived.
Can you talk me through, Delaine, some of the art and performances at the festival? Give me examples. I know it's made up of art, theatre and music performances.
Well, the artists could either work on their own or they could collaborate with other participants. So we had the Dom Alchemical Sisters, which was a performance piece by Mihaela Dragan, Ryan Knight and Mihaz Kukervic. And that was a sort of futuristic, but also a part. It was like a futuristic performance based in an idea of also coming from the past, but being in the present. And it sort of set the tone for, it had like a time scale of a couple of hours in it about changing things and also coming from the community. And some of the text was in Romani as well, which was interesting for people. Francisca Farkas did a number of different interventions within the whole about 2 hours the performances lasted for. And Damien James Labar, who's my son, he actually wrote a piece that was about, and it was in German. So it was also multilingual, the performances. So there was English, Romani, German. We wanted it to be not just predominantly an English production as well. And so he wrote a piece which Hamza Petici played in, which was about being sort of captured in books as characters, really, and escaping from that. Christoph Horath did a number of performances, including one called Chameleon Man, which was actually about skin colour, because one of our slogans has also been for some time is we believe in radical diversity, because as a community we are very diverse and people seem to have a very particular way of seeing us or what we should look like. Lindy Larson, we had a video of Lindy's because he couldn't be there for this performance, but he performed in the Hilton Zimmer on the Monday evening, which was a video of one of his performances that he does.
I was watching a video online that was made before the Biennale, and somebody described one of the pieces as being scandalous and beautiful, punk, burlesque and cabaret. How did the work and the whole event actually, how much of it was about celebrating identity and the Roma culture, but also about tackling negative stereotypes?
Well, it was sort of about all of that, all mixed up together in a sense. So all the different pieces that were made by the artists, it was their, you know, it was their text that they, so they came up with the text, they developed the whole pieces of work, and it really was about, so I think we touched on a lot of subjects that are sort of out there, but are also maybe a little bit taboo even within the community. You know what, no one wants to talk about the fact that there is an issue connected with skin colour within the community. And this was talked about within the performances by a number of the different artists taking place. So issues like that are actually something that need to be tackled, but we can talk about it in different types of ways. And also, you know, there was the cabaret aspect to it, which was also in Hilton Zimmer, but also in The Long Night of Coming Out. So it's about dressing up, being able to feel that you're in a safe space to say that, yeah, I am, this is who I am, this is me. I may be queer, I may be this, I may be that, but I'm quite happy and I feel safe enough to say that.
The artist Elaine Labar, the co-curator of the Roma Biennale.
Hi world, my name is Sharky. I'm a hip-hop artist from Chitungwiza in Zimbabwe, and you're listening to The Cultural Frontline with Tina Dahili.
Hello, my name is Björk. I'm in Iceland, and you're listening to The Cultural Frontline.
When you think of the Persian Gulf, you might imagine modern skyscrapers, luxury hotels, and the vast shopping malls of Dubai and Abu Dhabi. But if you look beyond the recent mass urban development, there are still ancient treasures to behold. And one of those treasures is Feyleka Island, situated 20 kilometres off the coast of Kuwait City. It has a unique history, and the Kuwaiti writer May Al-Nakib has been exploring the story of this island, frozen in time.
What you first notice about the Kuwaiti island of Feyleka is shattered glass. It's everywhere, and sounds like ice crunching beneath your feet. And then you imagine you're in some frozen Scandinavian landscape, not on an island in the Persian Gulf. The second thing you notice are abandoned, bullet-ridden buildings. It's as though all the inhabitants collectively decamped, an army marched in, took aim, and fired. That is, in effect, what happened in three consecutive waves. First, in 1990, Feyleka, like the rest of Kuwait, was occupied by an invading Iraqi army. Next, in early 1991, the island was liberated by coalition forces. Today, the island is used by the Kuwaiti army for training purposes. Each wave of violence added and continues to add to Feyleka's glass shards and bullet scars. For the last 2 years, a group of friends and I, all of us in the field of cultural production, have spent the night before New Year's Eve on Feyleka. We're drawn to its sparse beauty, waterfront expanses and desert vistas uncluttered by billboards, silence so intense you can hear yourself think, darkness pricked only by the occasional shooting star. The island's history is ancient and layered, and when we're there, we feel it in our bones. Alexander the Great set up an outpost on Feyleka and named the island Icarus, after the mythological sun who flew too close to the sun, but also, it is believed, after the Greek island of Icaria, which mirrors Feyleka's shape. The meaning of Feyleka is uncertain. It could mean outpost, or, as Jihan Seyed Rajab has suggested in her book about the island, it might derive from the Greek phrase Filiki Icarus, or friendly Icarus. There are ruins of temples to Artemis and Poseidon on Feyleka, but there are also remnants 2,000 years older linked to the kingdom of Dilmun, mentioned in the epic poem Gilgamesh. Excavation suggests that Feyleka has been inhabited since the Bronze Age. Maqam al-Khidr, the Green Shrine, is especially mysterious. Early 20th century photos reveal a mud brick building with a pointed dome. It was a fertility shrine, perhaps originally dedicated to Ishtar, the ancient Mesopotamian goddess of fertility. But Al-Khidr, the so-called Green One, is a cross-cultural figure mentioned in pre-Islamic, Islamic, and non-Islamic texts. He's highly venerated, considered variously a prophet, saint, immortal spirit guide to both Moses and Alexander the Great, environmentalist and trickster. He has shrines dedicated to him all over the region and beyond. When we visit Maqam al-Khidr, what we find is a mound jutting into shallow crystal waters where the shrine used to be. The government of Kuwait demolished the shrine in 1974 after a religious scholar declared it a pagan monument. Until then, it was frequented by women hoping to become pregnant. It was also a popular picnic spot. On our visit, we wander around the emptied space, pondering the legend of El Khidr, whispering our wishes for creative abundance in the year ahead. The ruin is a symbol of a past in Kuwait that was vibrant because it was diverse. The nation's maritime and desert population, unafraid to embrace different practices of faith, languages, and cultures. It is simultaneously, however, a symbol of that time's passing. Great things could still become a Felika. Glorious buildings from the 1950s and 60s remain standing. Abandoned schools with airy rooms facing the sea, one-story bungalow homes suited to the landscape. These could become cultural complexes or artists' retreats. An aura of magic conducive to creative work encircles the island, the combined residue of Alexander, Dilmun, and El Khidr. Kuwaiti playwright Sleiman Al-Bassam has a vision for developing a cultural center on Felika and has already established an unofficial artist's residence there. His is a vision counter to the one that saw fit to demolish the Green Shrine. A grand dream, worthy of Icarus, but perhaps as doomed. Not because it isn't possible to actualize Felika as a working cultural hub, but because the tendency in Kuwait is to demolish the past and build shiny high-rises rather than to repurpose what's already there. Commercial forces override all other considerations, especially artistic ones. There's a plan to transform Felika into a vacation resort with malls, hotels, manufactured villages, and an artificial canal slicing the island in half. Construction has been on hold, but it's only a matter of time before the project gets underway. For now, Felika remains a suspended island of shattered glass, bullet holes, ghosts of the past, and writers' dreams.
The Kuwaiti writer May Al-Nakib on Felika Island. Next week, we have a treat in store for film fans. As part of the BBC Arabic Festival, we're taking the temperature on Arabic cinema and asking whether we are now living through a golden age of film for the region. Join us to find out how Arab filmmakers are telling extraordinary stories during turbulent times. If you're in London and want to come along to the event, just go online to bbc.co.uk/worldserviceradio and search for The Cultural Frontline, and you'll find a link to the tickets on our webpage. And you can hear the discussion right here on our programme next week. Has a work of art, a book, a song, a film, ever changed the way you see the world? Recently, we've been speaking to comedians, writers, actors and musicians about exactly that, the art that changed them. And today it's the turn of the critically acclaimed Danish film director and screenwriter, Lone Scherfig. Now, Lone has been described as one of the best Nordic filmmakers of her generation. Her films have included the comedy Italian for Beginners and the Oscar-nominated drama An Education. She told the Cultural Frontline about how the work of the director Michael Haneke changed her outlook and her vision as a filmmaker.
My name is Lone Scherfig. Michael Haneke's The White Ribbon is a film that really changed my perspective on filmmaking. When I saw The White Ribbon, I thought that you could reach a higher level than anybody else had been able to, where emotion and intellect and aesthetics meet at a level I had not previously seen.
Sie keine Angst, dass Ihre Schüler Sie auslachen, wenn Sie da so mit mir tanzen?
Martin, pass auf!
The title refers to a silk ribbon that the children have to tie around their arm and go to school with to prove that they have done something they shouldn't. It's a sign of innocence. And that in itself has very strong cinematic value because it stigmatizes the children but still insists on the fact that they have done nothing wrong. The film will prove otherwise.
Müssen alle sterben?
Ja.
Wirklich alle?
Ja.
It's shot in black and white, but it's CinemaScope, and it is full of untold things, things that happen behind doors, things where you have to put two and two together, mystery, people who react in ways you wouldn't have expected. And then when you step back after the film and it keeps staying with you for days and days and days, then things fall in place. And what you see is a mosaic where you can suddenly get it into focus and discover that what you actually have been watching is the crib of Nazism. It's Austria in the 20s in a small town.
Schicken Sie mich nicht weg. Ich habe so Angst auf der Landstraße.
And I think this film you have to watch because it explains so much about our European history and identity. And it says so much about good and evil and mass psychosis and how evil can grow out of something very little. You don't want the film to end, and it doesn't. It'll keep twisting and turning in your mind where you see the story from different angles constantly for years after. Michael Haneke is Austrian. He takes his world extremely seriously, the way with every film he investigates a new subject matter where form and contents and asking big questions meet. That I is so impressed with, and he has raised the bar for me. So I try with every film to not just have a script and a directorial take on it, but also try to make a film that is a cinematic answer or poses cinematic questions that are relevant and important.
The director Lona Scherfi on Michael Haneke's film The White Ribbon. And if you want to hear more from the world of film, then make sure you tune in to The Arts Hour with Nikki Baty right here on the World Service. Another Oscar winner, the Chilean director Gonzalo Maza, will be joining Nikki to talk about his film A Fantastic Woman, which follows the journey of a transgender woman struggling to cope with the death of her lover. And that brings us to the end of today's Cultural Frontline. If there's anything you'd like to listen back to, or if you've missed any episodes, just go online to bbc.co.uk/worldserviceradio and search for us. I'll be here same time next week with more stories of artists changing the world and the way we see it. Until then, goodbye.